It's not that rare for people of means to head south when winter approaches. Our next guest is doing just that, but he's going way south. And not for the first time. David Cothran has visited Antarctica and the North Polar region several times over. It's part of a career taking travelers to exotic places for exploration and photography, and even for diving in ice-cold water. David Cothran is a biologist by education, but he's picked up a few more skills along the way, including scuba diving and photography, so you can guess where he takes lots of pictures. Underwater, yes, and often in very cold water. David Cothran, we're impressed. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you very much.
Your biology skills, I noticed, resided for several years at the Point Reyes Bird Observatory north of San Francisco. It sounds like your attraction is largely to birds.
Well, started with birds, I think, as a field biologist. I was trained as a cell biologist working in the lab, but I figured out pretty quickly I didn't want to spend my career in the lab, especially in the basement where the electron microscopes live. So I started working with animals out of doors, and birds were the first thing that I was attracted into. They're fascinating organisms, a lot of fun to study all around the world.
Indeed, and so many people who obviously take a great interest in birds. But then, so what sends you offshore in search of more far-flung creatures?
Well, just a constant desire to explore, I think. I'm fascinated by almost any part of the natural world. So an opportunity to see it in different places, it changes so much from one place to another. Every continent has its own different kind of wildlife. Birds are particularly great that way. I think people are attracted to birding because everywhere you get off an airplane, there's going to be new and different birds to go and explore. And that's what I like about it.
And yet some of them, they travel thousands of miles to go to winter feeding grounds and things like that.
That's right. Birds are very peripatetic as well. They're kind of following them around sometimes.
So what do you do? It's a Lindblad Expeditions National Geographic, which is kind of a long name. So
yes,
you've got the National Geographic part in there. What is the organization about?
Lindblad Expeditions is expedition travel company. We run a fleet of six ships and destinations all around the world. And we have a very close business alliance with the National Geographic Society that's 11 years old now. They provide some of the guides on our ship, especially photographers who work with us in our photo programs. And we are their sole cruise travel provider. So if you book a trip with National Geographic, it will be on one of our ships. And we're all branded National Geographic, so it's a very tight alliance.
These are not big ships, I understand. These are not the Agony of the Seas or whatever the largest ones
That's
are
That's absolutely right. Nothing like the big cruise vessels that do the Caribbean and places like that where you have 2,000 or 3,000 people on the ship. Our largest ship, the National Geographic Explorer, has a capacity of 148 guests. It's about 300 feet long. So that's like a lifeboat on one of those big ships.
So no amphitheater, no zip lining, I'm thinking on these ships.
No zip lining, no climbing wall, no midnight chocolate buffet. That's too bad.
That's the one thing you regret not having, right? Do the people, so you teach photography on the expeditions, is that right?
That's right.
And so do the people who you're teaching photography to dive as well?
Not on our trips, or at least not in the polar regions. Mm-hmm. When we go to places like the South Pacific, then yes, we have diving programs on board and I'll do some underwater instruction. But in the polar regions, our guests don't get in the water. Well, except for a polar plunge, They jump in for 30 seconds and we haul them back out.
And how blue are they after the 30 seconds?
Pretty blue even after 30 seconds. But we've got some nice whiskey waiting or something.
Okay, good. Ways to warm them up. So let's talk about what the photography expeditions are like. Because, even without actually getting immersed in water, the fact is you're talking about some starkly fascinating places, but starkly cold as well.
Well, that's true, but not as extreme as people may think. We go to the Antarctic Peninsula region, south of South America. Mm-hmm. It's the banana belt of Antarctica. It's the best place for wildlife. And conditions there in the Antarctic summer, when we go, say, November through March, are fairly mild, really. Nothing like the winter in Minnesota, for sure.
Really?
Yeah. Average daily temperatures in the 30s. Mm-hmm. It's unusual for it to get colder than about 20 degrees.
Wow. Okay. So there we learned something now. And how far out? I've noticed that arm, the Antarctic Peninsula. How far out does that stick out into the ocean?
The peninsula is about 1,000 miles long. Huh. So it sticks up a long way, a lot higher latitude than any other part of the continent, and just a short distance from the southern tip of South America.
And so where specifically do you go to, and what creatures are you generally looking for? I mean, penguins, obviously, seems to be probably a very popular subject matter for photography.
Absolutely. Penguins are the stars of the show, for sure. I think after penguins, probably people are most interested in the scenery of Antarctica. Ice, icebergs, craggy mountains. It's an extraordinarily beautiful scene to put wildlife into. Seals are very big. Leopard seals are always intriguing to people. And it's a great place for whale watching, too. Humpbacks and some other species of whales as well that we see fairly regularly. Killer whales. There's a lot of killer whales that live in that area.
Are they? I thought they were generally not for, for the coldest waters anyway.
Killer whales? Mm-hmm. They're actually found everywhere around the planet. They're probably most rare, really, in tropical waters. But they are found in the tropics. They're common in temperate waters, but around the Antarctic Peninsula, they're a fairly common sight.
I want to come back to diving in ice-cold water. I can't get off this, I know. But did you know how to dive before you took on really cold water?
Yeah. I've been doing it for 15 or 20 years before I became a polar diver.
So what does it take to A, prepare, and B, get used to those conditions?
Well, preparation is kind of a long story. These days, a little bit of special training is required, especially to use what's called a dry suit. When you're diving in extremely cold water, a wetsuit isn't enough. A wetsuit allows water to come in next to your body, and the insulation in a wetsuit also gets less effective as you descend. The air bubbles in the neoprene compress, so wetsuits don't do a very good job of keeping you warm in extreme conditions. Instead, I wear a dry suit, which is a full-body garment with tight seals at the wrists and the neck that's waterproof. So most of my body doesn't get wet. I'm wearing a warm, fluffy undergarment underneath. And probably the most important thing of all is that I have a line from my tank to my suit so I can keep a little bit of air in the suit, which keeps the insulation from being compressed.
Oh, okay.
So there's a lot to do in getting all that on and getting ready to go. I can talk a great deal more about gear if you want to hear about it.
I may ask about that. I'm just fascinated by the diving in really cold water. We'll come back and talk about that with David Cothran. I should point out he'll be speaking. Welcomed by the Department of Environmental Science and Policy at the Southern Oregon University at the Stevenson Union Thursday afternoon this week at 12:30. That's the Stevenson Union, room 330 at Southern Oregon University. David Cothran, working for Lindblad Expeditions National Geographic. We'll come back and talk more with him about his exploits and the people he's taken with him when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to David Cothran, who's a bit of an Arctic explorer. He leads expeditions showing people how to do what he does, which is take fairly amazing pictures in fairly amazing places. He spends a lot of time in the polar regions working for Lindblad Expeditions National Geographic, and he'll be speaking later this week at Southern Oregon University. You can join us right now on the Jefferson Exchange and ask questions about the life of the rugged explorer. I was asking if he's got an odometer. He said no. He doesn't know how many miles he's traveled, but it's a lot. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I know we always marvel at the colors and diversity in tropical waters, but you kind of opened my eyes with some of the photography I had a chance to see that you have done. It seems like there's an equal amount of diversity in polar waters as well.
That's absolutely right. And that's the thing that really was the most fun part of doing that job, that it was constantly surprising to people how rich and how beautiful the marine life of Antarctica is. There are many brilliant colors. It's a huge contrast between what's above water, which is mostly ice and rock and blue sky. Very beautiful, but very stark. You get below the water and suddenly you've got brilliant orange anemones and bright yellow sponges. And it's a wonder world down there.
I've watched some of your YouTube videos. There's about half a dozen on your YouTube channel. And in a couple of them, it looks like you're seeing things that maybe science can explain, but you couldn't on the spot anyway. Things you hadn't seen before.
That's correct in a few circumstances anyway, a few opportunities. The places we go, the things we do, give us a chance to just run across things that people haven't seen before just by opportunity. So once in a while, I've had a circumstance to record something that I thought would be valuable and pass it on to various researchers. And another thing that makes our explorations particularly valuable is that we run an ROV, a remote operated vehicle, mm-hmm. that can take a look at fairly deep conditions, which gives us, again, a chance just to see things that aren't seen very much.
Goes down about 1,000 feet or
about
so?
About 1,000 feet, that's right.
That's how get. That'll get you to some fairly dark water.
Very, very different world down there. Totally different marine ecology than closer to the surface.
But just the things you've seen with your own eyes and your own camera, without having to go through the ROV, one of the images you showed was a crinoid. Is that the name of the creature?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. That's right, a feather star. Uh-huh. That's probably my very favorite of any kind of Antarctic animal. I love penguins and I love whales, but the feather star called Promacocrinus, it doesn't have a common name. It's an extraordinary animal. It looks like its arms are made of ostrich feathers. There are 20 of them, and it's almost 3 feet across. So it's beautiful when it sits there, and when it begins to swim, it's a stunning and fascinating motion, like nothing else.
Well, and here we are on the radio, not able to show the picture, but it can almost be described as a living fountain. Its method of locomotion is just this constant flowing of limbs.
That's a good way of putting it, I think.
That's pretty amazing. So, but I noticed that there's an environmental ethic here. You don't take samples away with you, even if you're curious about, wow, I wonder what science would make of this. You just take the picture and leave the animal in place.
That's correct. I think that's very important for us ethically. And there may be cases in which we'd pass information on to scientists and they'd be interested to return to the region and do some sampling. And that's their job. Our job is more to just have a look.
So I noticed you're leaving in about 2 weeks to head south again. What are the destinations this time?
I'll be flying down to Ushuaia in southern Argentina, which is where our trips begin, and then from there going to the Antarctic Peninsula, as I often do, to the Falkland Islands and to the island of South Georgia. South Georgia sounds like someplace near Atlanta, but it's an Antarctic island that is southeast from the Falklands. Beautiful place.
South Georgia, is that the place where Shackleton ended up getting to?
That's correct. Yes, Shackleton's men were marooned on Elephant Island in the South Shetland Islands, and he made the trip from there 800 miles to find rescue at South Georgia with the whaling stations there.
Grab your headphones, because we actually have a phone call from a listener who apparently has something to relate about the Shackleton Exposition. Jeannie in Medford, welcome to The Exchange.
Good morning.
Hi, go ahead.
Excuse my voice, but every time I think I'm cold in Medford, Oregon, I pull out my old Geographic and I reread and reread over the years the Shackleton Exposition. And I feel warm all of a sudden.
That's amazing. And so you've read this many times, I gather.
Oh, yes. It's one of my favorites. I love your stories about exploring. And I'll go ahead and listen. And I'm fascinated as well as Jeffrey about how in the heck do you get in that ice-cold water? I did it once on a dare.
Wow.
And I instantly was paralyzed.
Wow.
And had to paddle towards the edge of it was a frozen swimming pool, but nonetheless, I cannot even imagine. Thank you.
All right, thanks, Jeannie. Take care. So how long had you been diving when you did do your first ice water plunge?
Around 15 years or so.
Really?
It's really, like Jeannie, you just have to kind of grit your teeth and go for it. You throw yourself in. The first few times, it's something that you just don't know what to expect. And it's fairly intense experience the first few times. I got ice cream headaches, where you had that intense temple headache. Every time I dropped into polar waters for the first year or two, and then slowly my body got more used to that kind of stress, I guess. In the dry suit that I mentioned, your body doesn't get wet, so most of your body is not immediately shocked by the cold. But your head is in a neoprene hood, so your head does get wet right away. And that's pretty intense experience.
Oh, I can imagine. So I want to round out the story about Shackleton. This is the Shackleton Expedition of, what was the year?
1914 to 16.
And his ship got stuck in the ice, and he managed to get the people all off the ship safely. Didn't lose a single person. They lost the cat, didn't they?
They lost the cat, yeah. But every member of the expedition survived. It was a remarkable story of courage and heroism. And they had to drag their lifeboats across the pack ice of the Weddell Sea for many days. They finally made it to Elephant Island. They were in the boats on open water and then made it to Elephant Island, the last possible point of land they could have come ashore on, and an absolutely horrible place to try to spend any time. We've visited the places like Point Wild where their camp was, and it's not a place you would want to camp. And then Shackleton's Journey, greatest single open ocean boat journey ever made, I think, across to Elephant Island, 800 miles. Missed Elephant Island, mm-hmm. 4,000 miles to South Africa.
Wow. That is amazing. Do you think about the explorers who've gone before as you're sitting in your relatively warm and safe steel-hulled ship sipping whiskey?
Absolutely, we do. And it's exactly that way. We travel in great comfort. We have wonderful restaurants on board and comfortable cabins and hot showers. And we spend a good bit of time thinking about how different it was for those men and about the amazing work they did. There's so many great stories from those explorers. Very well-known stories like Shackleton, much less known stories like my favorite explorer is Charcot. Jean-Baptiste Charcot mm-hmm. was a French Antarctic explorer.
And in fact, I was looking at one of your videos. You had actually found some of the physical evidence of where Charcot made land.
That's right. There's a well-known place where he and his ship, the Pourquoi-Pas, overwintered at Peterman Island along the west side of the peninsula. And I had the opportunity to dive in the little bay called Circumcision Harbor, where his big, not because of anything that happened there. It was named for the day, the Feast of the Circumcision, when they set up their camp. But we did find some little pieces of the Pourquoi-Pas, which was wonderfully exciting for me. Really a thrill.
Bands of metal or something.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Yeah. Why was the Pourquoi-Pas? I mean, is that the why something?
Why not? It's called the Why Not.
I can't think of a better name for a polar exploring vessel.
He had named several of his ships that, and I think it's a fantastic name. I agree. Best possible.
Our guest is David Cothran, who is an Arctic explorer in a sense. He works for Lindblad Expeditions and National Geographic, lives here in the Siskiyou Mountains, hard by the state line. We'll be talking on Thursday afternoon at 12:30 in Stevenson Union 330 about Seen and Unseen, a photographer's view of natural history. You can join us now as we talk about some of David's exploits around the world. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I know you've been at this for a while now, but give us a sense of your first trip to, I don't know if it was Arctic or Antarctic, but your first reaction to seeing some of the animals and the sights.
Well, I think my first reaction, I went first to the Arctic, to the archipelago called Svalbard, maybe best known for the name of its major island, Spitsbergen, north of Norway.
Mm-hmm.
And the polar regions are really different kind of place. The ice, I think, is probably the most striking thing when you first enter the polar regions. The huge number of glaciers dripping down all the mountains, but more than anything else, frozen ocean. Frozen ocean makes a different world, different from anywhere else on the planet, and it's quite striking.
Since you're proceeding by ship, I mean, do you get a chance to get a day by day sort of like, okay, it's just this much different from yesterday? Or?
Yes, that's particularly true going north up the Norwegian coast. We start in fjords where there are small towns, and we get on buses and go to see a beautiful glacier, and then we get up into more northern fjords where things are more remote. Stop at Tromsø, the high Arctic town, and then off into the very remote wilderness. So yeah, there's a progression there. Not nearly so much visiting the Antarctic. And when you go to Antarctica, one day you're in South America, then a day and a half across the Drake Passage, and then bam, you're in the middle of it in the Antarctic Peninsula.
Wow, just all of a sudden you're there.
Yeah.
So, I mean, does it ever get, I mean, can you ever be blasé about it, or does it still surprise and awe you every time you see it?
I would never get blasé about it. Surprises and awes me every minute. You know, one thing is that no matter how many trips you've done, and I think I've been to the Antarctic close to 100 times, close to 100 different trips, every day is different. You never know what's going to happen that morning, what the weather is going to be like, what wildlife encounters you'll have diving or cruising on the surface. There's always something new coming around.
So as you look at the reactions of the people who have booked passage on these trips, I mean, do you sometimes spend a little time looking out the window at what the sights are and a lot of time looking at them to see what their faces are doing?
I do interact with them a lot, of course, because that's my job, is to create an experience for them that will enrich their time in the Antarctic. But no, I think I actually spend most of my time looking out the window or looking around us, because what I want to do is notice what's happening and help them to notice, help them to understand the phenomena that we encounter.
Are you still seeing things on each trip that are new even to you?
Not every trip, because I've had quite a bit of experience there, but frequently, every season for sure. And in the season, I may do 4, 5, 6 trips. So there's always something new going on.
I think it was a New Yorker piece I read recently where there was somebody had actually spotted an emperor penguin, which apparently is not that easy a thing to do.
Not that easy a thing to do. That's right. We do see emperors almost every season around the peninsula. They nest on the ice further south. So we don't usually, except in very exceptional circumstances, go to where their nesting colonies are. But after nesting, the emperors kind of spread out. So with good luck, we can find a solitary one now and again.
I talked to a writer who wrote a novel about big cruise ships in Antarctic waters. And so there was a bit of an environmental effect going on there. I wonder what you make of the larger cruise ships ending up in those waters, much larger than the 150-passenger vessels that you're around.
Well, our company helped to found an organization called IATO, the International Association of Antarctic Tour Operators. IATO has very strict ethical guidelines for all of its members. But to be an IATO member, there is a ship size cutoff. So these big cruise ships, generally they're doing a trip from Santiago or all the way around to Buenos Aires. And they spend a day or two in the Antarctic. They just go to see the scenery. They don't get off the ship as we do and make landings. And because their business is different than what IATO controls, they are not signatories to this idea of self-policing. And I think the environmental ethics there are extremely important, not least simply emissions. Our ships have been converted to diesel, to light fuel from bunker fuel, which makes a big difference in how much particulate we put out, something we're very proud of.
Yeah, no heavy black smoke out there, which the bunker fuel is prone to. Talk about changes you may have noticed over the years in things that can be ascribed to climate change, global warming.
That's a very good question and a common question, and not a very easy one to answer. When you're in polar regions, it's difficult to observe as someone standing on there in the field the retreat of ice because there's just so much ice. It's a huge part of the landscape all around you. There are some places where you buy a landmark that you've seen before. You can see where the ice has retreated. There's an island I know off one of the islands in Svalbard, just a little rock, that was in the face of the glacier when I first saw it. And now the face of the glacier is about half a mile back and the rock is a little island. So you can observe things like that if you're really watching for it. As a diver, then I've seen ecosystems change at least to a small degree. I've seen kelp become more common in places where sea ice cover is less common. More sunlight in the water, more kelp that pushes out some organisms that lived there before. So yeah, there are changes going on and definitely ones you can see simply by looking around.
Our guest again is David Cothran, who works for Lindblad Expeditions National Geographic. Deb in Talent has a question. She writes, does Elephant Island look any different now than it did when Shackleton was there because of climate change?
It does look different. If Shackleton and his men returned to the site where they had been marooned, they would recognize the changes right away. It's still an extremely forbidding place. It's cliffs of rock and giant glaciers coming down. But Shackleton and his men, when they were there, camped at the corner of a glacier on a little beach. That glacier has retreated now something in the neighborhood, a few hundred yards, a quarter mile or so back. And that's allowed winter storms to come in and wash away all the sand of the beach. So the place where Shackleton camped is even more difficult now because it's all big boulders and surf running through them. So Shackleton for sure would notice a change immediately.
I hadn't stopped to think about what Shackleton would have done for campfires and things like that. There's no wood there, right? There's nothing grows?
No, there wasn't, and they pretty much had no fire at all. They camped under their boats. They huddled together to keep warm. It was very, very severe conditions.
Wow. Again, a very amazing thing of the Shackleton Expedition. 100 years
Incredible.
Ago now.
That's right. This is the 100th anniversary.
Wow.
Just finishing
up. A couple of questions about things you've seen down below. I was surprised at one thing, at finding coral in cold water, and I think it was one of the Norwegian shots you had.
That's right. And in fact, soft corals, not the kind that build coral reefs in the tropics, but soft corals like gorgonians. If you're a snorkeler or a diver in tropical waters, you're probably familiar with sea fans and things like that. Those are quite common. They're relatives, quite common in waters in the Arctic and the Antarctic. They succeed very, very well in cold waters, partly because the water itself is so rich. Cold water is a good place for things like kelp to grow. Kelp feeds some organisms at the beginning of a food chain, and that rapidly results in good conditions for a huge variety of animals. Corals are definitely neat ones to see and surprising to most people.
So, I mean, as much time as you spent in these environments now, I mean, can you look around and go, hey, wait, that doesn't belong here? I
mean, to a degree, yes. I've logged around 300 dives in the Antarctic, and that's enough experience, not by any means to see everything that's there, but to kind of get a feeling for what's common. So when I came across something I hadn't seen before, it was, you know, exciting and fairly easy to notice.
I was going to ask about the shipwrecks, too, because I noticed you had what looks like an old Viking ship or something in one of your dives, or maybe it's not that old, but it was in, I think, one of the Norwegian dives.
Yeah, you might be thinking of the wreck of the Plus in the Åland Islands. I have not dived many wooden shipwrecks anywhere in the world. I've done a fair amount of wreck diving in the Antarctic and in other extreme areas, but I'm not exactly certain which one you're referring to.
I'll have to ask when we come back from a break. We'll
yeah, take great.
Now, David Cothran's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He takes people on expeditions and teaches photography in places where there are truly stunning things to take pictures of. We'll come back and talk more with David and take more phone calls and emails from you if you'd like to join us when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 30. Don't forget, too, that it is fun drive time here on JPR. It is, in fact, the second to last day of this fun drive, and we welcome your pledges of support at 888-552-6191 or at ijpr.org. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to David Cothran, who leads expeditions, leads photography classes aboard expeditions for the company Lindblad Expeditions, National Geographic. And so he spends a lot of time in polar regions, particularly in Antarctica. He'll be giving a talk brought in by the Department of Environmental Science and Policy at Southern Oregon University. This will be Thursday. That's this Thursday, October 27th. At 12:30 at Stevenson Union, room 330 on the Southern Oregon University campus in Ashland. He's here now. If you have some questions about what it's like to explore these polar regions above water and under it as well, because he does dive, join us with your calls at 800-838-3760 or by email at jx@jeffnet.org. So, asking about shipwrecks, we're talking about the Plus that you found in the Baltic Sea, was it?
Yes, that's right. I have to say, I didn't find it. I was shown it by a good friend who's a wreck explorer. Little archipelago called Åland, which is between Sweden and Finland. Mm-hmm. The Plus was a commercial ship, a three-masted bark, which was returning to home port in Åland in a dense fog and went up on the rocks there. She's an all-wooden vessel that's one of the most beautifully preserved wooden wrecks in the world, I think. Absolutely stunning. The rigging is still there. The beautiful scrolling around the bowsprit is still there. It's a deep, dark, cold dive, but it's gorgeous.
And so why is it still so well preserved, particularly when it's a wooden ship and you'd think a lot of it would have been eaten away by now?
All around the world, the thing that eats wooden ships are called teredo worms. They're not actually worms. They're a kind of clam, but they drill through wood like a worm would. And they don't live in the Baltic. Almost anywhere else in the world, wooden wrecks get eaten up by teredos. But the Baltic is too brackish, too much fresh water in the Baltic for the teredos to live. So it's one of the world's greatest repositories of wooden wrecks. For over 1,000 years.
So even in the Antarctic, I mean, these worms exist to munch up old shipwrecks?
No, there are not teredos in Antarctic waters either. That's right.
All right, which raises the question I was moving on to then, which is there a pretty good record of pretty much anything that's gone below the surface of the water given how cold it is in the Antarctic? I mean, are there old shipwrecks and God knows on snowmobiles and jeeps and things around?
There are all of those, but the record is sketchy. A lot of early exploration was done commercially by whalers and sealers, and they definitely didn't want to share their records. When scientists began to visit the Antarctic, some of them were better at sharing than others. So there is really good information on early explorations that were done, and better and better as we progressed through the 20th century and people started being more rigorous about keeping records.
Given that these cold environments, though, I mean, it's not like things really have a chance to decay as they do in more temperate sorts of climates. And so I want to come back to the environmental ethic that, mm-hmm. that must be exercised when you're out there with Lindblad expeditions and get some sense of what the instructions are to people who come on land or anything about what they can and can't do.
Impact is really, really important to us, of course. And there are strict guidelines for wildlife is the first thing you learn. You can't approach any animal, penguin, seal, whatever, closer than about 15 feet. The penguins may walk right over to you, which is great, but we have strict rules about how close and what kind of interactions you can have with wildlife. But also just common sense things like, of course, we don't smoke on shore. If you're a cigarette smoker, then you do that on the ship. We never take any food ashore, so we're not likely to leave behind wrappers. And we look for more subtle impacts, too. On land in the Antarctic, very, very little lives. One thing that you do find there are moss beds. That moss takes centuries to grow. So it's very important for us that our guests should be aware of these moss beds, be interested in them. They're amazing and beautiful places to see. You don't want to be stepping on them.
Sounds like the instructions for tundra times 10, because it takes that long for these things to grow.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
So flip it around then, the environmental ethic going the other way. Does anybody actually clean up in these places or collect the garbage that might have been there from missions and expeditions there earlier in history?
That's an interesting question, and the answer is not much, because in the Antarctic, material is defined as historic and protected by the Antarctic Treaty or by the South Georgia Heritage Trust when it's only a couple of decades old. So whaling stations, for example, on South Georgia, those are historic ruins. So they can be cleaned up under very, very strict guidelines for safety, but they can't be removed to remove human impact. That part of human impact is thought to be an important part of the Antarctic story now.
It's already happened, so
yeah.
It gets preserved
yeah.
there. Wow. Go ahead.
Oh, we do occasionally come across flotsam on the beaches, and that we do take out. Things that have floated up there. The world's oceans are all connected together. There is fishing in the Antarctic seas, so we come across rope and lines and plastic trash and things like that. That we pick up and take out any opportunity we have.
That was my next question, was about whether you see plastic trash and you know, juice boxes and old soccer balls or all sorts of other things out there.
Yeah. Worst of all are nets and nylon line because of their interaction with marine mammals. Seals, fur seals in the Antarctic particularly, will play with them, get their head stuck in the net, and then as the animal grows, it constricts around their neck and creates a terrible wound. Mm. We've been able to save some animals that have had this called a ring neck, when you have a piece of plastic stuck around the animal's neck. We've been able to save some here and there by tackling them and pinning them down and cutting it off, which is challenging, but feels real good.
Wow. Well, and that raises a question, too, about any sorts of dangers you've had, any hairy moments with polar bears or walruses or any other creatures out there that might not have appreciated your presence and your camera.
Never had any hairy moments with polar bears, which is really good because they're really, really scary. Gotten out of the water really quickly one time when some walrus were approaching. But there's one animal that really stands out in my experience, which is really probably not all that dangerous an animal, but really thrilling to be around, and that's leopard seals. A leopard seal is around 10 feet long, around 1,000 pounds. It eats penguins. It's got a gigantic mouth full of really sharp teeth that it's not afraid to show to you. When you encounter a leopard seal in the water, it's very, very exciting. They are not very aggressive in the water, but if they wanted to, they could just rip your leg off in a second. So it's something you really want to be aware of, you know.
I sense a great respect there for leopard seals.
Great respect.
One of the pictures that you put up, and I think it was on your blogs, on your own website at davidcothran.com, and you set us up pretty well. This was not something particularly easy to look at, but it involved a polar bear whose mama polar bear whose cub had been killed by a male. I guess the major question is, how did you get that picture? Because it looked like you were relatively close to them.
This was a really great circumstance. I mean, a lucky circumstance for us, because it's something that's known to occur by biologists, but very seldom observed. We just happened to be out there in the ice looking for polar bears. This was in the neighborhood of Lancaster Sound up near Baffin Island in the Canadian Arctic. And part of what we do there is just cruise the ice looking for bears. We want to see if we can get close and get images of a bear. We happened to come across a mother and cub, and then the male walked in and there was a chase. The mother and cub got away. Then they came back and there was another chase, and that time the cub got caught. It was very distressing to watch, but fascinating at the same time. It's something that I've read about and never, ever expected to see.
It's nature at work, and nature is not always a pleasant sort of thing going on.
That's right.
Animals do eat each other and kill each other. How long have you called Southern Oregon home?
Been in Southern Oregon about 19 years now.
Mm-hmm. And I was reading that you and Lisa live completely off the grid?
That's correct, yeah. Our place is right at the very top end of the Colston Road. So power comes in to some homes above us and below us, but we're in a gap. Mm-hmm. So we have a micro-hydro system and photovoltaic solar power to back that up.
So you have a radio. That's the important thing.
Yes, we have radio. We have all the mod cons. We have a very modern system, and it works beautifully.
So what's the time split between being in your Siskiyou Mountain, Eyrie, and on the road and on the ice floes?
I'm generally out working on the ships about 7 months each year, 7.5 months each year. And that generally takes me to a lot of different places around the world. I'll probably spend 3 or 4 months each year in polar regions, mostly the Antarctic, sometimes the Arctic as well. And I just came back from a series of trips in Western Europe. So very, very different environment. Worked every continent in the world, 150 countries.
Oh, wow, 150. Are you technically now 150? Were they other different countries before?
Some of them have changed, yeah. Uh-huh. I don't keep up with the exact number.
Okay. Then I noticed, too, that one of the blog posts, you were in Polynesia not very long ago, which is a bit different approach to photography and the kinds of things you would shoot.
Yeah, that's right. A nice break from being cold all the time. As a photo instructor, Polynesia is challenging, I think, because the reefs and underwater work are difficult photography in their own right. And above the water in Polynesia, the scenery is idyllic, but not all that thrilling for photography. So I'm mostly a wildlife photographer, landscape. In Polynesia, we do a lot of people photography, which is fun for me because it's a little out of my comfort zone, a little more challenging.
So let me wrap things up with a question about the polar trips. And if there's a sense on these trips that people should pay attention now, because these areas could be very different in 10 years, 20 years, maybe even five.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's no question. You asked earlier about my observations of climate change in these polar regions. And as I said, that you can see some things, but there is no question that if you measure it carefully, these places are changing very, very fast. Who knows in the time of our grandchildren if there will be enough ice in the Arctic for polar bears to live the way they do at all now? It's an open question. And yeah, these places are very, very precious. They're genuine wilderness, which is another thing that's rare on our planet these days. So changing fast and really worth paying a lot of attention to, protecting very carefully, I think.
Well, we're glad you're there to help us pay attention to it and to keep a good record of it with all your photography. And I can't imagine how many hard drives full of material you've got by now.
A lot. 50 terabytes, I think.
50 terabytes. Wow, that is an amazing amount of photography. David Cothran, photographer, biologist, traveler. He'll be speaking on Thursday at 12:30 at Stevenson Union Room 330 on the Southern Oregon University campus, brought in by the Department of Environmental Science and Policy. Best of luck on your next trip south, and thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks very much. It's been a pleasure.
Absolutely.